This DoLectures episode features young farmer activist Severin von Schardner Fleming, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2016.
This is a rabbit. That's how I feel. I want to run into my hole. But the rabbit is afraid because the world is scary. But the rabbit knows we need to change things. And so I have to push buttons. There's a choice that you can make, whether we're going to talk about the things that give the rabbit nightmares on the left. This is the stump that represents ecological collapse. Or if we want to talk about land repair, land worship, land use, land health, sexy young farmers outside.
Can we do sexy young farmers?
Okay. Oh, I have to go forward. So thank goodness there's a lot of people who are also wanting to do that talk and do that work and be outside in the real practice of repairing our relationship with land and the health of that land. And there's a very great consensus. This is actually an international group, because mostly I'm in the US, but now in Europe also you have awesome, these are Canadians, Europeans, these are English Land Workers Alliance, these are Scots, these are French. This is a coalition across Europe. I guess still there's still collaboration with England. And those guys are from Romania. And all of these are groups that are working with a very coherent vision that has to do with a family farming economy where regions are autonomous and feeding themselves, where the land is being worked in a diverse way to restore the health, not spraying poisons, and that it involves young people, it involves innovation, it involves some technologies, it involves a sensible approach to land care. So there's a lot of drama and intrigue about the controversies, but in the young farmers movement, in the space that I live, we are very much in agreement and aligned what kind of food system we want to build together. So I'm basically just a party organizer. I organize, I've been organizing parties and gatherings for young farmers across the country for like almost 10 years. And we've done a lot, and we've done roasts, and we've done workshops, and we've, you know, done a lot of butchering of animals, and basically celebrating young people who are coming into agriculture and making sure that they can find their mate and find their land and find the skills that they need to navigate this complicated world. Oh my. And so part of the question that my rabbit is asking in how do we involve more people in caring for the land, and how do we involve more people in behaving in a way that helps the land, can we learn from the dancing that seems to come so intuitively as part of these land based peoples and all land-based traditions and all farm parties that involve dancing, and dancing that we all do. So the question of this talk is, how can we dance in the commons? And what are the steps for dancing in the commons? So one of the first steps, and again, I'm just a party organizer, so I'm good at lists, but I'm not really an expert in anything. One of the big first parts, though, it seems like, is intimacy with the place. And if you'll notice in the place where you're sitting right now, underneath your chair, there's a little something. So underneath your chair is also the land. So that place is always there, just to remind you, it's not an abstraction. And maybe you didn't notice that. That's like a pep talk, a little pep talk. It's not a button, you can't push it. It's a question of how to behave in relation to the land. These are women in Japan who are harvesting the seaweed. They're really up in it. They're really intimate with that. So I'm going to tell you two stories of functional, ecological, durable, healthy commons. Commons are places that are managed by humans, that are ecologies, that are in this case agroecologies, where humans have not degraded the landscape, where humans are able to sustain and themselves, and especially in marginal places, able to sustain human life. And so this is a valley floor in New Mexico, and what is called the acequia system. And you can see that the form that it takes is very much a truce between the landscape itself and our human kind of volition or aspiration or need. And the water is coming down the river, is being shunted off into a canal, you can see here, and then that canal is slowly irrigating out all of the farms in the valley. Compare that with some of the other kinds of forms that we are familiar with. So the acequia is a ditch commons. It's an ancient irrigation system that has occurred not only in New Mexico, but also in Spain. It was brought by the Moors from Africa. Its fundamental principle is the law of thirst, which comes from the Quran. The law of thirst is very normal in a desert. If you're thirsty in a desert, you're going to have some spiritual principles about thirst. Their theory is that the law of thirst says water must be shared. So the acequia is a system of water sharing. It's a ditch. The ditch has to be dug. The way that this is ritualized, the dance of this commons, takes place in the early spring with everyone who's on the ditch either coming themselves or sending someone to represent them to dig out the ditch. And they're called the pacientes. And then this guy here, he's called the mayordomo, and he's the steward or the custodian. He has to be worthy of trust. He has to be faithful to the water. He has to measure out the distance, which is about 8 feet, which is about a little bigger than a bathtub, with his little measuring stick, and then that gets assigned to a person to dig. And he has to make sure that it's dug properly and that all of the fittings are refitted. He has to negotiate with the other mayordomos when there's a time of drought in order to recalibrate how much water everyone needs for their laundry, for their chickens, for their home garden. And that negotiation is carried out across 1,000 acequias, some of them 23 miles long, across New Mexico. Until this day, it's now more than 400 years, still functional, not computerized. This is a very basic technology of lifting, letting the water drizzle out. That's at the time of establishment. Now, it should be mentioned, this was a conquered landscape. This was a settled landscape. I mean, the rules of the acequia were determined by King Philip of Spain also, and it was a settled landscape. So some of the settlement ideas that they had were that the lands that are selected should be healthy, good for planting and foraging, the sky of good and joyful constellation, clean and benign with pure and sweet air, without impediments or alterations, and with good grazing for livestock, forests and trees for firewood, and a plentiful supply of good water for drinking and irrigation. It's very sensible if you're a king and you're sending someone across the world to make sure they organize their own living. So that's what they did. And even on the cliffs, they're building the canals that can bring the water across an arroyo with a bridge and can bring it all along the valley floor. So here's another commons that's persisted in spite of ski slopes and nature conservation. Subsistence alpine commons were historically in Neolithic times people moving up and down in a kind of a transhumance way up and down the valley, from the valley to the Alp, bringing their cows with them to graze on the beautiful summer forage in the mountains. Shailen Wolseley is going up to the top of the mountain to catch his bell, and he got very tired on the way, but that's a big walk for a little boy, his big distances and big altitudes, and it's highly ritualized. Again, there's the obmann, who's the equivalent of the mayordomo, and he also has his three elected commissioners whose vote, who are empowered through the votes of all of the members of the co-op, of the members of the commune, of the members of the commons. He's then authorized to oversee that roads are good, that the avalanches haven't washed away the streams, that all the infrastructure of this bounded, healthy context is able to sustain the cows. And everybody who has the cows has a right to a certain number of cows. I worked on an alp like that, and the father of the alp had three sons, all of whom were very good looking, and two of whom wanted to keep farming, and so that farmer had bought, for basically the price of a sports car, the right to another cow off of another farmer, which was like 20,000 francs. So some of the rules of the commons are obvious. I think some of the rules are rules we already know from behaviors we engage in ritualistically, like dancing. They've also been studied by economists, and in particular an economist called Eleanor Ostrom, who was the only woman ever to win a Nobel Prize for economics. Interestingly, she was studying the phenomenology of healthy commons, and where there's a comedy rather than a tragedy. So one of the big things is obviously, I just have to say it, obviously, an alp is not the internet. Ecological commons are not going to have exactly the same aspect as the clickety-clack universe of digital world. The characteristic of a commons is that it's bounded, and it's bounded by the people who are living there and the relationships they have with the place. I'm going to get more into some of the rules that characterize all of these functional commons. But it seems like one of the ways that those rules are maintained and the way that those rules are normalized in the culture, and if we're asking ourselves, how are we normalizing better behavior in ourselves, or the kind of behavioral relation that allows the commons to be healthy, that maybe some of that happens through ritual and whimsy and parties. And why would it be otherwise that in all of these cultures around the world, at times of important inflection in the season, on the equinox, on May Day, in the darkest of winter, there are these very powerful ritual, kind of spiritual economies of exchange and story that help to kind of crack open the everyday and connect us in it's like between life and death. And in places where it's a marginal ecology, it is between life and death. So I made this picture for you, which is the commons is a dance you already know. And it's I'm going to take you through the 8 steps of a commons. Are you ready?
Yep.
So step number 1 is eye contact, which is clear boundaries to your dance floor, a clear frame of contact with the ecosystem. Number 2, you have to adapt to local conditions. So if it's muddy, you need to be wearing boots. Number 3, if it dries up, you can take your boots off. It can react to changing conditions. Number 4, make sure that everybody in the group is respecting the dance that's being danced. So there's a boundary. There's outsiders who respect the rules that you're making, and maybe you might even take off some more clothes. Then everyone's dancing, and it gets really wild, and then a mother on this corner says, she scolds, she says, "That's too fast. You're going to have to clean up the hall afterwards." So that's a sanction, and it's graduated penalties for misbehavior. Number 6. We have to watch each other, and we have to follow each other with our bodies and with our eyes, and we have to make sure that we're all dancing correctly. But that happens intuitively when you're dancing, and also maybe when you're commoning. And that one says, "I'm sorry. It's okay. You can put away the chairs." So that's called informal dispute resolution. Now, the last rule of the commons is we all have a shared responsibility to sweep the hall, to clean up the dishes, to bring a potluck, to put away our cups in the trash can, And those are the kinds of responsibilities that commoners who are part of a bounded ecological commons must also abide by. Okay, so that's all very like, I'm just a party organizer pretending to be an anthropologist. But I wanted to see if it could work and wanted to try and learn from the logic of a landscape and learn about lessons that relate to the appropriate scale for a regional food economy, the appropriate level of intimacy that's possible within the constraints of this world we live in. And so we just wanted to say, how can we do that? How can we transmit the truck scale agriculture that we're interested in to the landscape that we're a part of? So this was last summer. We had a really fun time shipping food from the farms of the food shed down the coast to the harbor, to the homes, to the city of its people, and essentially tracing the line of the landscape and tracing the boundaries of our kind of logical regional food and farm economy using the power of the wind. And this is the boat we used, and this is the coast we sailed. And these are the happy people. And we actually used 4 boats, and it was super fun. And we met lots of people that were also on that border between land and sea, and you're on the awkward, wobbly dock, and you're doing this kind of performative logistics that doesn't make sense on a lot of levels. And it was weird, and it was wonderful. And I think that it helped us establish relationships within a celebratory context that are highly relevant in either emergency management context or in the project of rebuilding a regional and relational farm economy. So the question is, can that ritual and that celebration or that dance or that party and the approach that we take relationally to that commons we share be transmitted through nice lawyers like that into a new commons? Like, are we capable not just of studying and observing and enjoying and relishing in the glorious, charming village and the glorious irrigation ditch, but actually building our own commons to hold land within the region for our kids to eat from? And so that's the question that drove me to go looking and looking and looking around and seeing who and what's going to happen about that, and learning these rules of the commons, and studying the project in France, which is called Terre du Lien, where they actually have built a new legal commons to hold farmland in perpetuity for community food sovereignty, for organic agriculture, which exactly mirrors these rules. It's bounded. You have a right to farm, but only organically. You don't have a right to destroy the land. You don't have a right to sell sod and export it from the region. You have participation from your community who've paid to buy that land and who then benefit from the food. So they are now, I think, about 250 farms that they've protected like that, giving access to the young farmers that I spent my whole life with, who mostly struggle getting access to land, who then, of course, are happy to oblige and grow gorgeous food. So this is obviously a legal process, and my work in the last year has been building that new legal infrastructure in the US so that we too can hold land in common and we too can administrate that commons effectively. But it seems like it's also an ongoing cultural process. It's ongoing behavioral context. There's a long tradition in American agriculture started by Benjamin Franklin, who was pretty notorious for his almanac. And his almanac was ostensibly about the seasons and the weather and what to plant when and how it should go, but actually it was highly political. It was highly charged. It was a manifesto on what kind of country he wanted to see grow here and what kind of character of behavior and the choices that are being made would lead us in the right flow, as it were. And so similarly, it feels like now that discourse that we have amongst ourselves and that inquiry is equally as important and ongoing. And just going to take a small diversion. Like, if you think about plants, if you think about the plants that we eat or the crops that we have, you know, 10,000 kinds of apples, and all of the different speciation that has occurred in all of these different environments where different, and even potatoes, how many different kinds of potatoes there are in the Andes. All of those plants, all of those food crops have come about because the humans were in a relationship with the genetics of their food, right? So the humans are like, oh, I like how that color is. Oh, this tastes really good. And then the plant has its own volition, has its own kind of vector that it's traveling along. And then the third vector in this gyroscope that goes on for centuries and millennia and yields us the food we have today, the third part of that negotiation or compromise is the stimulus of the ecosystem, of the climate, of where it's growing, of the rocks that it's near, and the hot, hot, dry, or the wet and mushy part of the place that it's in. And so it's that three-way truce that is taught and that's fluctuating and that goes through time that creates the bounty we now have. So it feels like that's part of the volition, the intuition, what the plant has going and what the ecosystem kind of is pushing is relevant. So now you know the steps of the dance and have some thinking about the theory that might inform the dance. And I challenge you to also, you know, organize a party or be an anthropologist. And let's dance.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.